And specifically, they were quoting from verses 26 and 27. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. We bless you from the house of the Lord. The Lord is God, and he has made his light to shine upon us. Bind the festive sacrifice with cords up to the horns of the altar. And the people and the priests would pray for Yeshua to come. Fortunately, they were worshiping the altar rather than the true Paschal Lamb who was going to die on the altar. See, the altar is where you go to be judged. There's no comfort at the altar. There's only judgment. There's either you being judged or the innocent sacrifice being judged in your place. And so their view of these festivals was distorted, to say the least. And it's always distorted when you add to the Word of God. So Christ is going to play off of these celebrations. He's not going to stand up and say, you guys shouldn't be doing this. Because they're not going to listen to him. But he's going to stand up and say what they should have been looking for during these celebrations. And so we come to this whole thing of the great day, the last day of the feast, and we have to go back to John to understand this. In verse 37, remember in last week's lesson, we skipped verses 37 through 39 and did just the dialogue of the people and the priests and the hierarchy with Christ. Well, this lesson, we're going to go back and look at verses 37 through 39, and then we're going to go from there directly to John chapter 8, starting in verse 12. Because these are the two great festivals that Christ is referencing. And I want us to look at them together. If we break them up, then it makes it more difficult to wrap our mind around how they're interrelated. Now, John starts off in verse 37, and most of our translations struggle with how to do this in English. So it says, on the last day of the feast, the great day. And then it gives the context that the last day of the feast is just an exciting day. It's the climax of the feast. It's been building to this great climax, and thus it's a great day of the feast. But in actual fact, that's not what's happening at all. The great day is the last day. Because it represents the melting of the heavens and earth and the white throne judgment. And in Greek, your adjectives can be strung out to give emphasis to them. But it would not be amiss to translate it into English as to say, and on the last great day, or on the great last day of the festivals. Festival. It is in singular. Jesus stood up and cried out. See, so the great day is conceived with Sukkot. It is not Sukkot. Just like the unleavened bread is consecutive with the Pesach, but it's not the Pesach. And same way with the barley offering of first fruits. Now, the water festival was held at the evening sacrifice, about 3 in the afternoon, 1500, if you don't live in America. And at sundown, the lamps were lighted in the women's court, burning the priest's old stained gowns. And, you know, these things were white. And after a year of sacrificing and blood and washing and blood and washing and blood and washing, it had to be pretty grimy. Even clean, they still had to be pretty nasty. And these were taken up and they were burned, and the priests were clothed in fresh white garments. Not unlike being clothed in the righteousness of Christ in heaven. Well, in eternity future. That doesn't mean that's what they thought, but that is certainly a good picture of it. And the men would march around the altar 7 times. Now, they thought they were depicting the fall of Jericho and the people entering the promised land and looking back to the great times God has given them. But they messed up a lot. However, they marched around it 7 times because 7 is the number of completion for God. And it is. It is the complete judgment. All judgment is done at the white throne judgment. There's no more judgment after that. But it completed what was begun at Yom Kippur, the day of that judgment, the day of that atonement. At Yom Kippur, you mourn for your own sins. And they will do that. But we're going to see where they do that in Zechariah. They mourn. They look upon the Meshua whom they, their ancestors, had pierced, had killed, murdered. And they will mourn, a great mourning, at Yom Kippur. That opens up the millennial kingdom. Well, at the end, you have the great last day. The last judgment. We need to get our bearings here. Now, where's the treasure? Because it says that Christ spoke in the treasury. Later on in John. Well, if we look at our graphic, we'll see where Christ was speaking in Solomon's porch. That's where he did his teaching. We talked about that in our last lesson. But now he's come into the court of the women. And that is where the treasury was. And we'd have these receptacles lining the court of the women, and people would drop their offerings there. And the priests, or the other Levite clans that assisted the priests in the keeping of the temple, would collect these and store them away in the storehouses there. Well, this is where Christ is doing his dialogue at. This is where he's standing up and talking up, because here is where the very devout are. And Christ announces himself. So he cries out on this great last day, possibly after the water festival, but before the evening lights. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. So they've been doing this water festival to pray for rain and to use as a picture of God's salvation, of how good they were. You know, they were keeping the law and being righteous and participating in having this time of great joy when it's all of works. And it was availing them dead, worthless. All this effort expended and it meant nothing but death. And Christ was going to have to judge that. So he stands up and he says, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. If they knew Isaiah 44, these very devout people, they would have understood that. He says, all who believe in him will become vessels of living water, indicating being filled with the Spirit, the new covenant. Now, Paul talks about this at length in his epistles. But how the body is the temple of the Spirit of God, and how the Spirit of God indwells us, and the Spirit of God empowers us. And some take that to very extreme ends. And some don't believe it at all. But John tells us that while Christ is crying out, come to him, he's indicating, John is indicating that this will happen on Pentecost. And indeed, when we turn to Acts chapter 2, we see what happened on Pentecost. And afterwards, and even today. In other words, Christ is clearly presenting him as Yeshua. They've been praying for Yeshua to come for 7 nights. And for 7 days, they've been praying over the water of his salvation. And on that last great day, he's saying, come. I'm here. Because he says, I am. He stood up. Down in chapter 8, verse 12. He says, I am the light of the world. I am name of God. God is the light of the world. How much plainer do you need to be? How much clearer do they want him to say it? That which they've been praying for every night has come to them. And those who believe in Yeshua will walk in the light instead of in the darkness in sin. Especially if they understood Daniel's schedule, that only Jesus meets all the criteria and thus is Yeshua. If you don't understand what that means, you have to go back to the previous lesson and listen, because I go into some detail about how God gave Daniel the schedule of when Yeshua would come, and they would know exactly when, down to the year and the month. Yet, he is rejected. They would rather dance in darkness and cling to their religion of works and try to snuff out the light of the world. Because that's what sin does. And you keep coming back to this fallacy of witnesses. You have to ask yourself, what witness are they going to accept? Christ said, I came from God. And I'm speaking God's message to you. How are you going to validate that? What kind of witness are you going to accept? Because obviously sinful people can't go to heaven, see the transaction, they weren't even made yet. Since this preceded creation, how could they then validate that message? How do I know you're speaking the truth? I know you just not have a schizophrenic psychotic break and you need more drugs. Which will slow you down and make you more delusional. See, so this is a false dilemma. It's a logical fallacy. They have no intention of ever accepting his message. Because they can't. Christ is the only one who knows he was with the Father. And he says, even if my testimony is all you got, I was there. Nobody else was here. In fact, here was not even here. There was no creation. The issue is not the witnesses, but the acceptance of the truth with the signs. The signs validate his message. John makes that clear time and again, as do the other Gospels. The signs validate the message because there is no other validation. There is no other witness to the truth but the Father and the Son and the Spirit. And they don't have the Spirit yet in the sense of the new covenant. Thus, it's the Father and the Son. The works are of the Spirit from the Father through the Son, validating the message, raising from the dead, restoring sight, never been done. Restoring hearing, never been done. These kinds of things that had never been done were the validation. The Christ says, you can only judge from the flesh. That is, empiricism. But it makes your judgment invalid since it's limited by the flesh. Not only just the sin nature within you and the sin in the flesh, which distorts your worldview, distorts your understanding, and prevents you from wanting to hear the truth or accepting the truth. It's just that the five senses are just not adequate. And you cannot know the Father because of your sin. And thus the truth is hidden from you. Again, your judgment is not valid. Now, this is going to drive them to the point of distraction. To be told that even if they had the evidence, it would be meaningless to them. And we're going to see this conflict throughout the Gospels. So it all comes back to his words. And they've already acknowledged that they are God. Come back to chapter 3. Nicodemus comes to Christ at night. And he says, we know you are a man of God, for no one can do these things that you've done unless God be with him. And Nicodemus was the teacher in Israel. And yet, they did not want to hear that. Sin never wants to hear the truth. It's only when God comes upon you and rips your mask of sin off that you see the truth and accept it. But it's not because of what you did or what you thought or how you found the truth. It's about how God came to you and overcame your sin nature with his grace. They're powerless against Christ. And John emphasizes this a time and again. They've already tried to arrest Christ and failed because the guards had more acceptance of Christ's truth than the hierarchy who sent them. That was in last week's message. Thus, Christ cannot be touched until the fullness of time. Until that Pesach, that Passover in AD 33, when he is to die, is when he dies. Is when they then arrest him. Until that time, they cannot touch him. It shows how powerless they actually are. Though they live in the illusion of power, they actually have no power. Christ has a power. And they cannot arrest him until Christ decides this is the time. and allows himself to be arrested, allows himself to be tortured, examined, allowed himself to be put on the staros, allowed himself to then face the justice of God. Allowed himself. And all the while, they have the illusion of power. That is the problem with the flesh. You think you have the power, but you have nothing. You think you have a handle on life and are untouchable, but you have nothing. The Christians need to step back and look at the world and the events as God sees them. It is a scary, ravenous, destructive place. Only by the grace of God are the forces held at bay that rage against you personally, both saved and lost. So adding to God's rituals clouded the picture of Christ. Just like throwing that story in there of the woman caught in adultery clouded the coming judgment of Christ. Their ritual of water and lights claimed to look for the coming Yeshua, but they were looking for a coming human being conquering Yeshua that would bring death and destruction. How is that different? How is that supposed to be different? And why is Christians today in churches, those who call themselves evangelical and conservative and whatever label, other label you place on yourself, how do you worship the very government that spreads death and destruction? We should be preaching Christ alone. That is what we need to do. Like Christ, we neither speak for nor against the government. Like Paul, we neither speak for nor against the government. We only speak the truth of the kingdom to come. And we saw what that did with Christ, we saw what that did with Paul, what that did with Peter, what that has done throughout the ages, and especially what that is doing to those who call themselves Christians today, at the hands of others, slaughtered by the thousands, and nary a word out of that very government these churches claim to worship. Oh, we don't worship. Yeah, you do. We stand there and worship the military might and the police force of the state. You are worshiping that government. We should not be doing that. We should be preaching and teaching the truth of the kingdom. Thus, these festivals and stuff mirrors the truth. The most dangerous elements in the world are not simply the lost, but the pious religious lost who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. You want an eye-opener for a view of American history? I can't speak to other countries. If you go and read the latest book published in the name of Murray Rothbard called The Progressive Era, it was published posthumously from his notes in his lectures, in which he attributes much of the influence in American history to piety. Now, piety is not a good word. It is those pious elements that force their morality onto the lost, onto others, using the means and mechanisms of the state. Now, those have been taken away from the Christendom piety and are now being used by the Gnostic elements, who have their own form of pietism and are using those same elements against the Christendom piety. And the true Christians are just steadily preaching the gospel of the coming kingdom. There's nothing you can force on the lost. They will not accept the truth of the scriptures unless the Father reveals it to them. All we can do is live it and talk it. And the work of salvation is then the work of the Spirit. So their rituals were futile. They were empty. Dancing in the darkness by false light. That's what they were doing. Worshipping the author of judgment. Their judgment. Rather than looking for light. So Christ redirected the attention and meaning of their rituals. He says, I am the object of true worship. Not because I'm God, but because I am sent of the Father and I willingly lay down my life to die as a paschal lamb for sin. They gloried over the joy of God's past actions, that he was here to give them true joy in his salvation of life for all eternity future. Those not called of God could not accept the truth. Now it's interesting to note that Christ is never seen as entering or approaching the court of the men or the priest's court. He's never seen in conjunction with the altar. That place has no joy for him. That is a constant reminder that he is going to die there in judgment. No, he went there because he kept the law. There are times he did present a sacrifice. But it's not written down. We never get to see him in that vicinity. And the writer of Hebrews demonstrates the knowledge of the great last day when he writes, it is appointed for a man to die once, and after that comes the judgment. But that judgment can be paid for in full by the Paschal Lamb of Christ. Christ offers him the opportunity to miss that second death, resulting in eternal judgment so they can experience the joy of their salvation forever. And he's offered it to us. That message moves out around the world. And the world rejects him. Much of Christendom claims to look to Christ, but finds joy in the works of supposed goodness. Social theology, social gospels, liberalism gospels, they're all about now. They're all about being in the flesh. They're all about scientism. That's not truth. That's lies. But that is where modern man worships today. It's all forms of Gnosticism. They think they will be heard for their much speaking. And they do speak ad nauseum at length. And they do write many books. And they do many lectures. And they make movies. And they make TV shows. And they make lots of hit songs that all tell us the same siren song of destruction. And we rush out there to immerse ourselves in the wrong culture. And unfortunately, that's in many of the churches today also. Thus, you cannot get away from it. And when you stand up and speak against it, it's like you're babbling. Just like Christ, when he stood up and cried out, and they said, you're babbling. Your witness is not true. Get out of here. You're bothering us. We're in the middle of the holiday season. But they will be heard at the white throne judgment. When the books of works are open, their own words will come out and testify against them and reveal their true nature. See, Christ doesn't have to stand up and say, "You did this, and I can prove it." He just opens up the books and we see their actions. We hear their words. They condemn themselves. That's that last great day. Day of sorrow. It'll also be against the Jews who rejected Messiah at his coming. Though they were praying for it, they really didn't want it. They didn't know what to share power with him. They wanted to control him for their own means, their own ends. And he was not going to be controlled by anyone. He was going to do the will of the Father. That was it. Thus, their dances, they were doing the dance of the second death, the final death, into darkness, surrounded by fire, which is kind of like what the lake of fire is. Darkness. You ever see true fire? It's all about darkness. The light is only on the outside. The inside is dark. Hence the flame. Christianity is not a new and different faith. We are an extension of Judaism. It doesn't mean we run down to the synagogue and join up. We don't sit back into the law. We don't step back into the Old Testament and pretend we're something we're not. Jerusalem Council in Acts 15 relieved us of all of that. But we have to clearly understand Judaism to understand Christianity. You know, I've read so many people. They're just so pridefully glorifying themselves as New Testament Christians, when literally they're just celebrating their ignorance. We need to stop that. Especially in eschatology. Because you get to Revelation, it's more about Judaism and the completion of it than it is about New Testament Christianity. We're not a different faith. Christianity is the new covenant extension of Judaism during this indeterminate period without cultic rituals. Now, to understand that phrase, you have to listen to last week's lesson. Otherwise, it makes no sense to you. You have to build on these lessons. The new covenant faith will come to Jews when Christ returns to establish his millennial kingdom. The Sukkot will be practiced annually by everyone. And when those who do not want to practice Sukkot reject it, and they will, God will pour out his judgment on sin and drought, so on and so forth. How important is this? Israel did not celebrate Sukkot throughout its judgment, throughout the period of the judges and the kings. They didn't see it necessary. They did not understand it. They didn't really care about it. Just like they didn't do the Sabbath to leave the land lying fallow. every seventh year, and really did not practice the year of Jubilee, which is the seventh of the sevens, or every 49 years, when you were to release people from their debts. They really did want to practice that. And there's so much more that they were to do under the law that they refused. There's so much more that Christians today learn and can learn from the scriptures and refuse. And thus they fall short. It is so sad that when they practiced their full Sukkot, when they came back under Nehemiah, and they read the law and saw this, they wept. But unfortunately, they soon became jaded in their practice, as shown in the book of Malachi. Didn't take long. And they're still jaded during the time of Christ. And that is what the gospel is showing us. Because John is not writing this during this time period. He is writing this much later. He's had a lot of time to think about it. He's had a lot of time to be taught of the Spirit. And he's writing these last words for us. And yet so many people come to John and see it as an easy book, moving book, but they miss what's actually there. I pray that if you listen to this, that you're not of that persuasion. That you're coming to hear and then going back and studying the scriptures for yourself. But all I've done is given you food for thought. That the Spirit will teach you the truth of His gospel, the truth of His word, so you may grow in grace with Him in your life, so when you stand before Him, you will not be ashamed, but be seen as a workman, building with His word. Thank you.